Hello, greetings to Reverend Gokyo Henkel and everybody else joining us from around the world. Before we get into the conversation, let's spend a few moments to bring our attention to here and now and to cultivate the right intention. And as we have a Zen master today, I chose a Zen verse to chant as we cultivate the right intention. I'll share that on screen right now. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. That's my try at a Zen chanting, doing it for the first time, in honor of having Reverend Gokyo Henkel. It's a great honor and pleasure to have you for this conversation, Reverend. This is a space where we are trying to share and exchange ideas and insights on Buddha nature. And first time for us to have somebody from the so-called Eastern Buddhist tradition. You being a Zen master, so it's great to have you with us here to share your insights, your experiences, and how Buddha nature is practiced in the Zen tradition and also the Chan tradition before that. So, Reverend, I normally begin this conversation by asking our guest, when you first came across the concept of Buddha nature and what kind of memory you have of it, any impression you remember? To this, of course, I hope, and I also hope the audience will be able to know more about you and your spiritual journey.
Yes. First of all, thank you very much, Lopan La, for inviting me and hosting the conversation. And thank you, everyone, for attending today. What a great topic, Buddha nature. Of course, hard to remember when first hearing this this term, but it was probably one of the first books that I read on Zen is the classic Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, where I went on to practice in his lineage. It's a simple but profound book, and he writes about Buddha nature a lot throughout this little book. And he says things like, to live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being. And he says, defining Buddha nature in this book, Suzuki Roshi says, Buddha nature means to be aware of Buddha nature. This is kind of a simple Zen-like way of describing Buddha nature, but I think when I first heard these things, I didn't really get what he was talking about, but over time, I feel like, wow, a lot is being said in these short sayings. Another phrase of Suzuki Roshi is big mind. I think he kind of coined this term big mind and as a word for Buddha nature. And Suzuki Roshi would say things like, everything is included within big mind. I think that was my introduction to the term and the concept of Buddha nature. And then of course, as I met teachers living it and practicing it, I got more of a feeling for Buddha nature and in the Zen tradition, and then meeting Sokhen Rinpoche and in the Dzogchen tradition, where they talk about it a little more explicitly and a little more accessibly, maybe. Then it really struck me, oh, these teachings of Buddha nature are something you really can practice, and they have these qualities of emptiness, clarity, and unimpededness, for example, that you find in the Zen tradition too, but a little less structured in Zen.
I remember, Reverend, attending my only Zen retreat in 1993 or so in South India with Roshi Harada Sekai.
Oh, and wonderful. Yes.
It was at Mahabodhi Society. And apart from me, I think almost all the attendants were from the Theravada tradition. And it was actually quite startling to sort of see him start the retreat. The first statement he made in the first session of the retreat was, "We are all Buddhas." And that was sort of, to me, a little familiar because I've been going through Tibetan Buddhist training already then, but a lot of the people in the audience were awestruck. And to me, it occurred how Buddha nature is perhaps central to the Zen tradition. So you again brought out this through Suzuki's words. What I'm curious is, what does big mind exactly mean in Suzuki? I mean, a lot of the Zen teachings are quite paradoxical and not as theoretically structured as, say, Dzogchen or Tibetan systems, as you said. So, like, even to live in Buddha nature is to die a small being. A lot of the people wouldn't quite get it. So can you elaborate a little bit?
Yes, in Suzuki Roshi's teachings, big mind, I think it was really a synonym for Buddha nature. I don't think he maybe never says that explicitly, but he's teaching Buddha nature quite a bit, and then sometimes we'll use this term. And like everything is included within big mind. And another thing that he says in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is this big mind is not related to anything outside of itself. We could say because everything is included within it, it's not related to anything. And again, it's kind of provocative, unusual language, because we often hear the teaching that, well, everything is related, everything is interdependent and related. So I think it's an unusual one way of putting it, that big mind is not related to anything, and that what is related to other phenomena is small mind, Suzuki Roshi says. So it's really talking about this ultimate truth of non-dual, all-inclusive awareness. One thing that in Zen, when they talk about Buddha nature and the nature of mind, they use the word mind a lot, xin in Chinese or Japanese, in a way that's maybe a little less meticulous than the Indo-Tibetan tradition. Sometimes mind is used for, you could say, small mind, dualistic consciousness or alaya vijnana. But sometimes the word, same word mind, is used for non-dual awareness, jnana, or Buddha nature. And so sometimes you have to kind of read in context when they use this word mind. They use it kind of loosely, it seems to me, in the Chan and Zen traditions, sometimes big, sometimes small mind.
Interesting. And of course, a lot of the people who know a bit about Zen and who have also heard about Buddha nature would be often thinking about the famous mukwan. Does the dog have a Buddha nature? And can you explain that as well? And how does that work with the general understanding and realization of Buddha nature?
Yes, that's maybe the most famous example of Buddha nature teachings in Zen, is that koan. But we can hear there's a whole kind of rich history of Buddha nature kind of behind that koan. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Of course, the teaching is that all sentient beings have Buddha nature. So that's kind of like a given, that understanding. So, you know, the rational answer would be, of course, a dog has Buddha nature. But then Jiaozhou, the ancient Chinese Zen ancestors, said, no, in Japanese, mu, there isn't any. So it sounds like, but that's not the teaching of Buddha nature. So this is the way that Zen people will talk sometimes. And I think what I mean by the rich history behind this is looking at whether Buddha nature exists or doesn't exist. There are teachings to support both sides. And in the Zen in China and other Buddhist schools in ancient China were exploring this issue, and partly in relationship to like Prajnaparamita sutras, where everything is negated. So is Buddha nature negated or not? There was some debate about this. And so that's one way of looking at this koan. There's other times, in fact, Jiaozhou, the teacher who said, when does a dog have Buddha nature or not, said no. On another occasion, he was asked the same question and he said yes. And then sometimes he offers little bits of more comments about why he would say yes and no. But I think the one that got most famous is just the simple, unexplained koan, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? No. And we could say here that this no is like, not just the, you know, no relative to yes, but the no of Prajnaparamita that's cutting through everything. Any ideas about Buddha nature, the monk who's asking, does the dog have it or not, is already caught in this dualistic mind. So it's this no that just, like Manjushri's sword, that just cuts through all conceptual idea. So as most koans, it's not so much like a philosophical statement as a practice instruction.
Thank you. That's wonderful. I've not got such an explanation before. It's really insightful. So it's really...
One other, while we're on the topic of koans, maybe I just mentioned there's quite a few koans, these Zen stories, really Zen dialogues that mention Buddha nature. Another, I think, really interesting one is that's quoted by Dogen in his Buddha Nature essay, as are most of these other stories. A monk asks the teacher Changsha, when an earthworm is cut in half and both halves crawl away on their own, right, in which half is the Buddha nature? I just think it's a kind of fun koan, right? And Changsha says, his reply is, don't be deceived.
Don't be deceived. That's fascinating. But this point to the fact that Buddha nature is described as being in the Sanskrit term, nishprapancha, isn't it? Transcending all elaborations and extremes, yeah. All constructions. So does then the Zen tradition generally accept Buddha nature as a synonym for emptiness? Or as there is in the Tibetan Buddhist traditions, this difference on some saying Buddha nature is more absolute, so big mind type that you mentioned, and then others arguing it's actually just emptiness, and a lot of controversy there. In the Chan and Zen tradition as well, there seem to be two thoughts. What would be the Japanese Zen tradition mostly talking about emptiness in a sort of Buddha nature in a self-emptiness form or in an absolute form?
Yes, it's an interesting question. Just like in Tibet, there are these debates about this. Similarly, in China, there are. And the way it plays out in Zen is like, does a dog have Buddha nature? Yes. Does a dog have Buddha nature? No. And I think in Dogen's Buddha nature essay, so Dogen Zenji is the 13th century founder of Japanese Soto Zen. The longest essay that he wrote is called Buddha Nature. And it's considered to be one of his most difficult writings. And I think he's in his own Zen style, it's very not so methodical or rational sounding, but in his own style, he's exploring, I think, these two sides. He quotes one's Chinese ancestor who said, all beings have Buddha nature, and another Zen ancestor that said, all beings don't have Buddha nature. And then he'll, in his Dogen-like way, will comment on these. And I think that I would understand that debate within Dogen's own writings, where he doesn't really land on one side or the other, is kind of like the Rong Tong, Shen Tong debate in Tibet. You know, at least it has some of that flavor on the emptiness side. And you know, Dogen does say at times Buddha nature is emptiness. And then, but just in case we get into maybe a nihilistic understanding of that, he'll say Buddha nature is everything, actually. Also, another thing that Dogen says is, quoting the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, this line that says, all beings completely have Buddha nature, is a line from that sutra, kind of typical Buddha nature phrase. Dogen kind of takes that phrase in the Chinese translation of the sutra and reads it slightly differently, which is legitimate to do with this Sino-Japanese character. U can mean both to have and to be, interestingly. And so most people would understand it saying all beings have Buddha nature, but he reinterprets this character U from the sutra to be saying all sentient beings in their entirety are Buddha nature. So the difference between have and are is a important distinction for Dogen. To say that beings have something called Buddha nature is a little bit dualistic, according to Dogen.
Yeah, paper you shared, one of the things that struck me from Dogen is he says mind itself is Buddha. So he's talking about our ordinary mind, isn't he?
Yes, mind itself is Buddha. I think it's one of those, we could even say early Chan, almost like definitions of Buddha nature. Mind itself is Buddha. This was a saying of Matsu, actually, originally in maybe 7th century China. And it became popular in the Zen world, and Dogen writes an essay about it also. Mind itself is Buddha. So I think really what Matsu, when you see Matsu talking about, what do you mean by ordinary mind? He says it's the mind that doesn't arise and cease and is unborn and undying. This kind of mind. So that's an example of, it's not actually, you know, citta or alaya vijnana or dualistic consciousness, but they're using this word mind. You know, mind itself is maybe a little bit like sen yid in Tibetan. That's how I would understand it when you see Matsu's comments on it, more like the nature of mind. But I think he's emphasizing in this very direct way that mind itself, the nature of mind, is Buddha. And it's so pithy and direct, it became a popular saying that a lot of Zen ancestors in China and then in Japan would comment on that saying. And another saying of Matsu, who is kind of a forerunner to the Linji or Rinzai lineage of Zen in China and Japan. Matsu also had this phrase, ordinary mind is the way. Mm-hmm. And similarly, ordinary mind is not our habitual discursive thinking mind, but just like in the Tibetan Mahamudra tradition, especially, this phrase, ordinary mind, is a beautiful phrase because it pointing to Buddha nature. It's very plain and ordinary. It's not something special. It's with us all the time. in that way, it's very ordinary, and always, it's always the case. And so a wonderful teaching that became popular from in the Zen world from Matsu, ordinary mind is the way.
Mm-hmm. These, when you discuss these, you have experience in both the Zen tradition and also the Dzogchen tradition. So mind itself is Buddha is the literal translation of Semyi Sanghi, which is a very common phrase you find in the Mahamudra and Dzogchen schools. And then even ordinary mind, I was struck that this is in Zen because you have the Tamelgi Shepa in Dzogchen, right? And also some of that used by the Gajupas like Karmapa Rangjung Dorje. So it's extraordinary how even in terms of the terms, the words, they're so strikingly similar. What is your take on the connection between Zen and Dzogchen? You know, of course, a lot of Tibetans allege that Dzogchen is an adaptation of Chinese Chan or some Chinese system, and often criticized it as not being authentic Indian Buddhism.
Yes, yeah. Very interesting, especially modern scholarly work on looking at the roots of Chan in China and Dzogchen in Tibet, and seeing a lot of crossover there. And Sam Van Schaik is one of the scholars who's particularly looking into early roots of Dzogchen and Chan. And he's got a book called Tibetan Zen, actually. Mm. It's early Chan texts, but written in Tibetan, found in Dunhuang caves and so on. But practically speaking too, I think there's a very similar, and like this ordinary mind is one example. Sometimes they use some of the same metaphors. Like I was happy to find that Baijiang, one of the early Chinese Chan ancestors, actually the disciple of Matsu, used this metaphor of Zazen, of meditation, like writing on water. So if you're writing words on water, they immediately disappear. They leave no trace at all. Mm. And that metaphor comes up in the Dzogchen tradition sometimes too. So it may be just coincidence, but maybe actually, you know, people were talking with each other early on, and they're great metaphors. Like, of course, the clouds blocking the sun is comes up a lot in Chinese Chan and Japanese Zen too. It's a metaphor for how our dualistic consciousness temporarily obscures the sun of Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. And then many other similarities between Zen and Dzogchen. The for example, sudden awakening, the emphasis on it doesn't have to be a gradual path. Mm-hmm. Of course, that fits in nicely with Tantra also, which is kind of got kind of mixed in with Dzogchen. They're kind of inseparable now in Tibetan system. And I think there was some early, you know, mingling of Tantra in East Asia along with Chan also. Mm. But so there's emphasis on suddenness and directness, and without a lot of conceptual study and investigation being needed, as was usually the case in earlier Chinese traditions too. And also the emphasis on lineage and the direct transmission of student to disciple is a strongly emphasized in both Zen and Dzogchen. And the non-duality of Buddhas and sentient beings. And
Another metaphor that I again found quite striking, and this, of course, is not just with Dzogchen or Mahamudra, but the whole sort of Tibetan tantric traditions, the use of the term great light by Ingo Kokubon. And it's almost equates with yourself, clear light that's so luminosity, that's so pervasive in Tibetan Buddhist traditions.
Yes, and, yes, definitely. Yeah, a lot of emphasis on light in Zen. And which reminds me of a nice story about this, about light. This would also, see what you think about this story being a kind of correlation to the display of awareness in the Dzogchen tradition, Rigtsal, where everything that we perceive is ultimately just the manifestation or display radiance of awareness itself. So the story is that Yunmen, another one of the great classic Chinese Zen ancestors, said to the assembly of monks, "Everybody has a light, but when you look for it, you can't see it. It's dark and obscure. Everyone has a light, but if you look for it as some objective thing, you can't, it's just darkness, you can't see it." And then he asked the assembly, "What is everyone's light?" And the assembly of monks was speechless. Nobody could say anything. So Yunmen answered on their behalf, "The kitchen and the temple gate." So it's, at first it sounds like one of these strange, just like most Zen koans sound very strange. But I hear this as a kind of a Rigtsal koan. We can't see the light in ourselves directly as some object, but everything that we see, supposedly outside ourselves, the kitchen and the gate, he was maybe could see them outside the window. Everything we see is our light.
Yeah. And in fact, if you don't see, you will probably have the the experience of seeing.
Yes, yes, not seeing is seeing.
Yeah, I like this idiom, the scenery of the fundamental ground. And you're talking about Rigtsal. Here we have the Kunshi, this is not the Kunshi, Alaya Vijnana Kunshi, but I think the Dzogchen Kunshi, the ground. And the scenery of the ground is a much more beautiful metaphor. So the kitchen and the gates and everything sort of becomes the scenery, or is included in the scenery of the fundamental ground.
Exactly.
Beautiful. Now, a lot of these things, the teachings in Zen on Buddha nature are based on the Mahaparinirvana sutras. So what are the main sutras or sort of texts that are the fundamental sources for Buddha nature in the Zen tradition?
Yes, quite a few sutras. In East Asia, there seems to be more emphasis on sutras, Mahayana sutras, as the basis for understanding, rather than the Indian shastras and commentaries, for whatever reason. So some sutras became very important in China early on, like the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flower ornament sutra, especially chapter 37 in that sutra is the manifestation of the Tathagata, and which is saying that all sights are the body of the Buddha, all sounds are the voice of the Buddha, and all thoughts and workings of the mind are the mind of Buddha. So it doesn't actually mention the term Buddha nature in the Avatamsaka Sutra, but many teachings, especially that chapter, seem to be a strong influence for early Chan and other Chinese Buddhist schools. It's almost like a precursor to Buddha nature teachings. Then the Lotus Sutra, very important in East Asian Buddhism, China and Japan. Not so widespread or renowned in Tibet. So it's interesting how different texts become really popular in different places. And the Lotus Sutra also is kind of a precursor, I would say, to Buddha nature. It doesn't use the term, but in chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra, the eternal lifespan of the Tathagata, is saying that the Buddha is teaching this sutra, and Buddha is saying, it's not really that I was, you know, born in Lumbini and practiced the way like this, that I was actually, you know, beginninglessly have been the Buddha and will be the Buddha. So it's a kind of Dharmakaya teaching, but I think it doesn't even use the word Dharmakaya there. But the sutra is very poetic, and Kumarajiva did a wonderful translation that became really popular in China with a lot of metaphors, like the lost son who wanders off from his home and eventually finds his way back to, as a poor beggar finds his way back to his father.
Now, the Lotus Sutra in the Tibetan tradition seem to have been used mainly for the single vehicle, the Ekayana.
Yes, yes.
And also a bit for illustrating how a lot of these Shravakas, the disciples of the Buddhas, are actually just emanations, and they are actually fully enlightened Buddhas taking the role of a disciple. So apart from those, as you said, yes, the Lotus Sutra doesn't have such a significant role. Compared to the Vajna Paramitas, for instance.
Right, right. And then, as you mentioned, the Mahaparinirvana Sutra is maybe really the main source for literally Buddha nature teachings in China. It's mostly about Buddha nature. It mentions the term over and over. In fact, Dharmakshema's translation of the Parinirvana Sutra into Chinese in the 400s, he's the one to translate probably the term Buddha Dhatu, although we don't have the Sanskrit original. It's probably Buddha Dhatu. He translates as Buddha nature, Busho. So literally a Chinese translation is Buddha nature. And that became a popular term in Zen, coming from this sutra, really coming from Dharmakshema, this translator, this kind of loosely translating Buddha Dhatu as Buddha nature, the Chinese character for nature. And that sutra has many Buddha nature teachings, and it equates, interestingly, one of the equivalents to Buddha nature is Ekayana, the one vehicle. And that sutra also Dharmakaya, Tathagata Garbha, and maybe most controversially in that sutra, Atman, true self, is not just mentioned occasionally in this long epic Parinirvana Sutra, but it's mentioned all over and over again. And there's stories and metaphors that bring out the meaning of this Atman that the Buddha says is not the Atman of the Tirthikas and non-Buddhist teachings. And yet it sounds very similar. But the sutra itself says, I think the sutra is aware that this is a controversial and radical thing to bring up. So it says, many people are kind of afraid of this Atman teaching because the Buddha taught Anatman. So why is it being taught here? And the Buddha says, well, once we're cured from grasping a separate personal self, that kind of Atman, but we're cured from that disease by realizing Anatman, then the Buddha, to some of these people who are now cured from grasping an Atman, now the Buddha can reintroduce this teaching of a true self. So it's an Indian sutra that's important in all Mahayana traditions, but that's maybe the most radical, controversial part of it, to teach this Atman. And it seems like in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, there's a lot of hesitancy to bring this out very directly. But it seems like in China, especially Chinese Chan and Zen, they were felt more comfortable using this term self. And you find it all through Chinese and Japanese Zen in just a colloquial way, talking about ourself as Buddha nature. So it can be easily misunderstood, but I think it's kind of nice that it's very intimate to use this word self. Yeah. It is our actual true nature. We could say that's our self.
But a lot of the sutras, I think including Mahaparinirvana Sutra and Lankavatara Sutra still underscore the fact that this self is beyond any conceptual construction. It's yeah. really still the one that's beyond is or is not existence yes. or non-existence.
Yes, and also it's not a personal individual self.
Yeah. Even while talking about Mahaparinirvana, you said the term Buddha nature that we have in English is actually what came via the Chinese tradition. It is quite interesting. Earlier, my friend Peter has sent a message from California pointing out the same thing. Basically, we have two Mahaparinirvana sutras in the Tibetan version. And there are three, but one is a non-Mahayana sutra. The two, we have one that was translated directly from Sanskrit, and that uses the term Sanjigikam, Buddha Dhatu, quite a lot. And then the longer one is what has been translated from Chinese to Tibetan, and that has the term Sangigi Rangshin. So I was doing a search, and the Chinese version has Sangigi Rangshin all over, as you said, the Buddha nature is all over the Chinese version. So the English term, I believe, the Buddha nature, the term Buddha nature we use must have come from the Chinese translation.
Yes. Yes, Tathagarbha.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, and Tathagarbha, they translate into Chinese the garbha as storehouse or womb, the character means. So that comes in. And sometimes just used on its own, like the secret storehouse. They'll sometimes use, I think it's actually in the Parinirvana Sutra, but they'll use that kind of term in Chinese Buddhism, referring to Buddha nature.
And one of the stories to illustrate what you were earlier explaining, I found this very touching. The story of a mother who has a child who is ill and has to be treated. Can you share that story used in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra to basically show how non-self was taught just to get over our clinging to the ego and now we have to move on?
Yes, yes.
So the story, you know, is, if you can share, I'll ask you to share.
Okay, yeah. There's two milk medicine parables in the Parinirvana Sutra. This one, I think the one about the mother, as I recall, is the child is drinking too much, is getting sick from too much milk from the mother's breast. And the milk here is like Buddha nature. Is the analogy. And so the doctor says, well, put some poison on your breast so that the baby won't take too much of this milk anymore. So she does that, the baby stops drinking the milk. And then I think it's something like the doctor says, well, now it would be good if they had some milk again. So take the poison off your breast, and so the baby can come back and have the milk of Buddha nature, or the milk of true self, really is what we're talking about, the milk of Atman. First, it's like poison, so it's not healthy. So you should find some skillful means to keep the babies from drinking the Atman milk, and then. But after they're cured from that disease, then take the poison off your breast and let them drink the Atman milk. And I think in the sutra, it says, at first the baby is very hesitant, like, I'm not supposed to go near that, that Atman, that self. isn't it toxic? And no, it's okay now. Now it's what you really, it's the medicine that you really need. So parables like that, very, very interesting and very conscious of the fact that this is a controversial teaching. Mm-hmm. It is okay in certain circumstances.
And talking about the use of the term self, now in the Tibetan tradition, as Reverend, you would know, the Ratnagotra Vibhaga texts, the treatise by attributed to Maitreya, talks about Buddha nature and defines it or qualifies it with purity, with the permanence, with the bliss and self. We have the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, I think, probably giving the most strongest presentation of Buddha nature in these terms, using the term self. But that text seemed to have not got so much influence or popularity in the Eastern Buddhist traditions, although it was translated quite early into Chinese. I was actually wondering why Ratnagotra Vibhaga didn't have that influence in the Chinese and the Japanese systems as it did in Tibet.
Yeah, it's a good question. As I said earlier, for various reasons, it seems that the Chinese mostly emphasize the sutras, Mahayana sutras, for their, to be the kind of back Indian backup for their teachings rather than the shastras. And I'm not sure, I never heard anything why that was, but I can imagine that maybe it could have been because the sutras are more like, they have more stories, and maybe the Chinese culture was more, felt it was more accessible to get the teachings with a setting of the Buddha teaching and talking with his students, rather than a more like philosophical treatise, which may be less familiar to the Chinese culture. But that, as you say, that Ratnagotra Vibhaga was translated in the 6th century into Chinese. And I did find that that Fatsang, who is the third ancestor of the Huayan school, which is the Avatamsaka flower ornament school, which is a great influence for Chan that would come later, he was very fond of this Ratnagotra Vibhaga. So he's maybe the main one who praised it and used it in his teachings. So maybe through him and the Huayan school, maybe its teachings kind of secretly filtered into China without most people knowing about it. And he was also the one who said that this Ratnagotra Vibhaga was written by Saramati, who we don't know anything about. Unlike the Tibetan tradition says, it's attributed to Maitreya, or Asanga wrote the commentary. Mm. So that's a strange bit of history that we don't
know. Just as we were talking, I was in fact wondering if attributing this text to Saramati and not to Maitreya would have played a role, because Maitreya is such a big figure. So perhaps in the Indo-Tibetan world, it is studied more because it's attributed to a Buddha author. Whereas Saramati.
Yeah, that's a great theory. That could well be. What? Yeah, exactly. It shows how important it is who wrote these treatises. But the teachings there for sure, permanence, purity, bliss, and self was taught in the Parinirvana Sutra and brought out in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga. Also, I think they're taught briefly in the Srimala Devi Sutra, which also a Tathagata Garbha Sutra that became kind of popular in East Asia. And one other sutra to mention in East Asia that's considered now to be apocryphal sutra, probably written in China, maybe even written by Kumarajiva, translated by him, is the Brahmajala Sutra, which is It's really a sutra about bodhisattva precepts, which are still that version of bodhisattva precepts is the one that caught on in China and Japan, and still that's what we use at San Francisco Zen Center from the Brahmajala Sutra. But in the sutra, it says these are Buddha nature precepts, which made for a very interesting flowering of kind of joining together of Buddha nature teachings with the practical matter of bodhisattva precepts and conduct in the world. The sutra says they're like natural way of acting that Buddha nature naturally manifests as these bodhisattva precepts. So that became an interesting part of East Asian Buddhism through all the different schools based on that probably apocryphal sutra.
And another text that is not known in the Tibetan world is the Awakening of Faith.
Oh, yes.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that was maybe around the 5th or 6th century. I sometimes attribute it to Ashvaghosha in India, but probably written in China, the scholars would say. And it's a unique kind of combining of Yogacara thought and Tathagata Garbha thought. And one phrase that gets used just briefly in that treatise is one mind. It's, I think, a kind of synonym for Tathagata Garbha or Buddha nature, the one mind. And that just colloquial phrase got became very popular in China, and especially Chinese Zen, the one mind. It's never quite defined, but we can imagine it as emphasizing that all beings share one Buddha nature. In other words, Buddha nature is not divided into millions of Buddha natures for each separate being. It's emphasizing the undivided nature of it. And actually in the Parinirvana Sutra, there's one short phrase where it does say there's one Buddha nature, not many. And that seems to get that oneness that seemed to become kind of prominent in China and Japan. Mm-hmm. Again, mind here is we're meaning the nature of mind.
Wonderful. Thank you. Let's take questions from the audience if there are any questions.
Oh, maybe just to throw in there to give it good credit. One more sutra that was important in China is Lankavatara Sutra, they say, which teaches Tathagata Garbha and Yogacara. And they say Bodhidharma, the founder of Chan in China, brought one thing with him from India to China, which was this Lankavatara Sutra. So that's a kind of a nice little Buddha nature textual transmission story through Bodhidharma.
Wonderful. Marcus,
we have one question coming through. Kathleen is asking, can Kokyo please define further those two different Atman concepts?
Mm. Yeah, that's a big topic. Because they're using the same word. So sometimes in the Indian tradition, they'll use the word Atma Paramita, so which is, you could say, is the transcendent self, or the self that's gone beyond self and no self. I think that's sometimes used in Ratna Gotra Vibhaga and others, maybe Srimala Devi Sutra. But sometimes they won't even qualify it with Paramita, they'll just say the Atman directly. So my understanding would be that the Atman that's problematic is the personal experiencer, that kind of Atman would not be Buddha nature, that's limited. But the Atman that I haven't seen this in the traditional text, but I like to think of it as not the experiencer, but experiencing itself, awareness itself as true self. And that one is not personal, and it's not a subject that's related to an object. It's it includes the appearance of both subjects and objects within itself. And it maybe the virtue of using this term self is it makes it very personal and direct, and it's not like it's not a nothingness. It's a presence. One Zen example using this term self, it's not using the Sanskrit term Atman, but the more colloquial way of talking about self, as used in Zen, is Changsha. One of the Chinese Zen ancestors said, the entire universe in 10 directions is the radiant light of the self. The self's radiant light. So that brings in this metaphor of light, and all kind of equates it with true self. And in that one short saying, also says that the whole world of appearances is also the self.
Mm-hmm. Even to use the term self, not to refer to what is actually the ground reality, the big sort of shunyata or dharmata or the dhatu that we're talking about. I mean, it probably is used with the specific aim of also getting people off nihilism, of some sort of totally negational viewpoint. So not necessarily to present a very hypostatic object of an ego or self-clinging, but really get people off the very nihilistic view, no?
Yes, I think that's a big part of it. Makes it more relatable to experientially, and also prevents it from being some kind of nothingness or nihilistic void. Interestingly, so there's this collection of important Buddha nature sutras that equate Buddha nature and Tathagatagarbha with Atman, self. But then in the Lakavatara Sutra, the Buddha specifically says, when asked about this sounds like the self of the Tirthikas, those other yogis in India talk about the self. And the Buddha says, no, it's actually what I mean by Tathagatagarbha is emptiness, shunyata. So it almost sounds contradictory to the Parinirvana Sutra on the surface, but I think it's just all these different aspects being brought out. And the Parinirvana Sutra itself does have Anatman teachings in it also. So very beautifully, it weaves them all together and tries to tease them apart, these two types of self.
Fascinating, thank you. There's some more questions coming through. Michelle Martin is asking, I've heard that Zen is a combination of the Yogacara found in the Lankavatara Sutra and the teaching of Nagarjuna's Karikas. Please, can you comment?
I think that Madhyamaka, especially as it came to Prajnaparamita, of course, Nagarjuna's Karikas were translated into Chinese too, and became more prominent in Tiantai tradition. I think a big basis for Tiantai was Nagarjuna and his middle way verses. Which of course Tiantai became very influential to Chan and Zen. So it maybe comes through that way, but I think even more Prajnaparamita, which you could say is the basis for Nagarjuna's teachings, is where it really it became very prominent in Zen. The Heart Sutra, we chant every day in the American Zen centers as the heart teaching of Zen. Through the sutras is the Heart Sutra that's negating everything as emptiness. So that's a big influence, and also Yogacara, big influence. And Tathagatagarbha, if we separate that out into its own school in a way, all three of those. And I kind of feel like between, you know, Madhyamaka, Yogacara, and Tathagatagarbha, that maybe Tathagatagarbha was most influential of those three on early Chinese Chan. It's really Buddha nature emphasis. Maybe later, and you know, from early days, but also later, maybe Prajnaparamita became more prominent and emptiness teachings, but they're always woven together very nicely. Yeah, all and unlike Tibetan tradition that tends to, people tend to interpret more from one side or the other. You have the, and Indian Buddhism too, right? Is there's like the Yogacara teachers and the Madhyamaka teachers. In China, they're not so conscious about choosing sides. They're very mixed together in a way that you can't even really pull them apart.
Thank you.
And also, yes, for Zen Huayan, the Avatamsaka school, based on that sutra, but also lots of philosophy that got very complex. The Huayan had a major influence on early Chan and later Chan and Zen also. And the Chen Tai school of Juri, was considered kind of a founder of the Chen Tai school, very popular in China and in Japan. It became like all of Buddhism was pretty much Tendai Buddhism at the time of Dogen. So then Dogen and some other teachers started these new schools like Zen in Japan, but they were they grew up in the Tendai school, so very influenced by it. And just while we're on the topic of Chen Tai, Juri, the 6th century founder of Chen Tai school, did write a little bit about Buddha nature. He was more into Nagarjuna and the Lotus Sutra were his main influences. But when he writes about Buddha nature, I found this interesting that he talks about a threefold Buddha nature. A lot of Juri's teachings come in sets of three. And the threefold Buddha nature is Ri. In Japanese, we say Ri is like the principle, Li in Chinese. Principle is a kind of Chinese way of talking about ultimate truth or emptiness. That's like the Dharmakaya aspect of Buddha nature. And his analogy is it's like a gold mine. And then wisdom or jnana, or awareness, or qi in Japanese, is the Sambhogakaya aspect of Buddha nature. And that's like, Juri says, that's like knowing that there is a gold mine, mm-hmm. this aspect of Buddha nature. And then the third aspect is practice, gyo in Japanese, or skillful means. It's like the Nirmanakaya aspect of Buddha nature. And that's like the tools that we can use to dig up the ground and discover the gold mine, since we know that it's there. So that's kind of a little different sounding than a lot of the Indian descriptions of Buddha nature. It's a creative new Chinese way of talking about it, but that was early on in China. So that type of teaching filtered into Chan and Zen.
That's really interesting. I've never heard that before. Yeah. Karma, have you ever heard something similar, this threefold Buddha nature in Tibetan tradition?
No, not in this specific form. Yes.
I think he also, Juri, even, I didn't bring it up because I wondered about this, but sometimes it's even talked about those three are the three causes of Buddha nature, which sounds a little funny to me because we're talking about Buddha nature is unconditioned, but maybe it's in his unique ways, the causes of realizing it maybe. Sometimes and Parinirvana Sutra was an important source for Juri's Chen Tai teachings. And in that sutra, there's a lot of teachings that seem a little bit contradictory. Like Buddha nature is unconditioned and all pervading and eternal. But then it's also like it arises dependent on practicing the precepts, for example. And it's only it's only really, Buddha nature is only really there for a Buddha. You hear that kind of teaching also. So maybe this idea of Buddha nature being caused is something on that aspect of it.
Hmm. And we certainly have Buddha nature presented in relation to the three kayas, okay? But I think what you presented is quite distinct, quite different.
Especially in Dzogchen, that Buddha nature gets talked about as three kayas in all of us, in all sentient beings. And you hear teachings like that, that's another Dzogchen Zen correlation. Like the sixth ancestor of Zen, Platform Sutra, talks about our own awareness is these three kayas. And he describes them slightly different than Dzogchen tradition would, but that same principle is there in early Chan.
It's actually interesting you brought in Dzogchen, because in Dzogchen you have Kadak, Tundup, and Tuji. And in a way, what you shared is quite similar to these three. Unlike the presentation of Buddha nature in Ranagota Vibhaga or other sutra traditions. Interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
That's really interesting. There's a few more questions coming through. Anna asks, is Dogen's Shikantanza similar or the same as, or related to Dzogchen in some way? If so, why are there no preliminary practices for Shikantaza
means just wholeheartedly sitting. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think if I was mentioning a lot of similarities between Zen and Dzogchen, some differences are, Dzogchen traditionally emphasizes the Nunro preliminary practices. We could find that similar principle in Zen. It's just not so structured, and it's not 100,000 counting, but these kind of devotional practices are quite prominent in Chinese and Japanese Zen. The principles of Nunro, refuge in Buddha, and reciting that daily, bodhicitta, like these four vows that we recited at the beginning of today's talk. Making offerings to Buddha. Dogen has a whole essay on each of these. Dogen wrote an essay on taking refuge in Buddha, on several essays on bodhicitta, a whole essay on making offerings to Buddhas, a whole essay that's emphasizing repentance. We don't have Vajrasattva recitation, but we have repentance practice, confession and repentance of karmic actions emphasized in all of Chinese Buddhism, but including Zen, and devotion to the lineage and the teachers. So those principles are woven in, but they're not as structured and emphasized in Zen, especially American Zen. I think we tend to emphasize the just sitting part more. The teachers who brought Zen to America, maybe that's what they really picked up on, but American Zen monastery like Tassajara, there's a lot of ritual practice, group practice, and of course in Japanese Zen even more. But another difference in Dzogchen and Zen is Togal, of course, we don't really have that principle, that kind of practice in Zen, although you could say like the principle behind it, like the whole universe in 10 directions is the radiant light of the self, is maybe a kind of Zen principle of Togal. Now, as far as Shikantaza, that's just sitting, just wholeheartedly sitting. The ta is like a kind of exclamation point, like an emphasis, Shikantaza. And it means just sitting. And so people interpret this Shikantaza in so many ways because Dogen doesn't define it so precisely. You could say his whole Shobogenzo writings are all bringing out the meaning of Shikantaza, including his Buddha Nature essay. But sometimes I think people interpret it as just a shamatha practice, just letting go of all thought, and that's it, which could be considered shamatha practice alone. But sometimes it's interpreted like the precursor of Soto Zen in China, in that Shaodong lineage, Hong Zhe's teachings of silent illumination. It's kind of a precursor to Shikantaza. And silent illumination is, in Hong Zhe's teaching, he says the silence is like the shamatha side, and the illumination is like the vipassana side. So it has a little bit more of like of accessing the radiance of awareness. But yeah, people interpret Shikantaza so many different ways. So because I practice Dzogchen and Zen, my understanding of Shikantaza would be more like Rigpa practice, like non-dual awareness. But that's just me.
No, I think Reverend, I sort of also understand more or less in the same ways. I've known a little bit about Shikantaza from my Zen, a short Zen experience. And then even the Nyendro practice in Dzogchen, I'm not actually quite sure how long it has been around, because the structured Nyendro system we have here today is pretty much both sutra tantra practice, an amalgamation of the two, and I think also largely based on the Lojong, which seemed to predate the Nyendro regime. So in the early sources, you don't really have the kind of Nyendro regime that you find today, and certainly not this strict 100,000 numbers and so forth. I think it's become a little regimentary now. But what you find
also in Dzogchen, we also have the particularly Dzogchen Nyendro of Korde Rushin, which is maybe a little bit more connected to Togao practice, and very, very unique and unusual compared to Zen practice. So I think Zen has also been largely a monastic practice in Asia. So I think something about that monastic life and Zen really very communal in both China and Japan. So in the meditation hall, you sleep and eat on your seat in the meditation hall right next to another person. So you're really like all thrown in there together, and day after day doing all the ceremonies together. In a way, maybe that's like a kind of Zen version of Nyendro, just how to get along with all these people.
And the Dzogchen version of Shikantaza, I thought would be, as you said earlier, the shine you have to do before the actual mind pointing instructions, the tenche, the shine with characteristics, and then the tenme shine particularly, where you drop all thoughts, the shine shamatha practice without characteristics. Marcus, shall we go on with
maybe the question? Could I add one thing in here about Shikantaza? Is people, as I say, people interpret it different ways. In Dogen's universal instructions for Zazen, Fukan Zazengi, one of the instructions in there is this in Japanese, Eko Hensho, which literally means turn the light around and shine it back, which is a kind of poetic way of saying, be aware of being aware, like that. So there's teachings like that that are kind of pointing out Shikantaza a little more methodically. I think that's a particular kind of method in Zen for accessing Buddha nature, turn the light around and shine it back.
Fascinating. We have some more questions. Do you want to have one more, or?
Well, I don't know, Marcus, whether we should go on, because we still have 27 attendees and quite a few questions, it seems. So please shoot away.
Sure. So on the topic of Zhiyi, I wonder what you think of his six Dharma gates to the sublime as fundamentally a Buddha nature text. It seems like the six different Dharma gates all have the view, in quotes, of Buddha nature at their core.
Yeah, so this is a Tiantai teaching by Juri in the 6th century, and I think it had some influence on Zen. But the six Dharma gates are using the breath, but in this unique style of Tiantai. So the six gates are counting the breath is the first. He might first present the view in this treatise. I can't quite remember exactly. But the gates are counting the breath. Then when that becomes too coarse, following the breath. Then when that becomes too coarse, stopping, which is the Chinese translation of shamatha. So it's sort of playing with the idea the breath seems to stop, but really it's the mind is stopping in stillness. And so then the breath is not really operating so much. The fourth, as I recall, is seeing, which is the Chinese translation of vipassana. And so it's bringing in the teachings of emptiness at this point. And then the fifth, I think it's returning. And that is like turning the light around and shining back. It's like reversing. It's like the mind that is doing the vipassana. You turn back and look at the mind that's doing the vipassana. I think is the fifth gate. And then the sixth is purity, where it's the final stage. So it's more methodical. Tiantai is a little bit more methodical kind of meditation than Zen. I think that type of teaching, because it's interwoven with the view based on Nagarjuna and the Lotus Sutra and the Parinirvana Sutra, Juri's main influences, that they're all kind of have the view woven into them. But then Zen as a tradition, similar to Dzogchen, it likes to not set up any systems at all and just cut directly through. And we don't need six gates. There's just one gate and this is it. So all the Tiantai teachings are there in the background. And also Zen, you know, it came out of these more scholastic schools, Tiantai and Huayan, that were getting more and more complicated in China. And I think there was some feeling of we need to go back to the roots and find some, we're getting too bogged down in the concepts. We need to find Buddha's awakening here and now. So Zen is traditionally said to be the separate transmission outside the scriptures, pointing directly to mind, realizing true nature and becoming Buddha. That's the phrase that was attributed to Bodhidharma, the founder. So it's, all these sutras are in the background, and a lot of the Zen ancestors in China and Japan did quote these Mahayana sutras, but it's also known to be this transmission outside the scriptures and really outside Tiantai and any kind of formulations.
Interesting. So we have another question. Michael's asking, is there an equivalent in Zen to mandala practice in Vajrayana?
Mandala practice, like the mandala offering?
I guess it doesn't say anything else about which mandala practice they're speaking about.
It's like the mandala offering in Nundro in the preliminary practice. It's really
of deities, visualization, perhaps.
Yeah, mandala, the deities and visualizing mandalas. Is any of that in Zen?
Can we clarify the question?
Oh, just about the visualization of mandalas or deities, this kind of thing that appears so much in Vajrayana. Okay. I guess the person is asking about that.
Okay. If it's the mandala offering, I would just say making offerings to Buddhas is a big part of Zen in general, even without a mandala. Visualizing deities. Not so much. It's so direct. And there is a little bit like maybe a sort of kind of Vajrayana principle there is in early Chan, it was kind of seen that the abbot of the monastery was like the deity. So it's a little like guru yoga in that way. In early Chan, for example, in one of the early writings about kind of setting up the monasteries, attributed to Baijan, I think, he says, in Zen, we don't have a Buddha hall. And of course, in modern Zen, they have a Buddha hall, which is where you do the chanting, and it's the main shrine hall, and then a Dharma hall for Dharma talks. But in this early treatise, it says, we don't need a Buddha hall because we just have a Dharma hall. And when the abbot sits up on the altar, that's the Buddha. So I think there's that principle in early Chan and throughout. And also each person being the Buddha themselves. And I think that partly comes through monastic decorum and practice of, especially Soto Zen really emphasizes like dignified action in every action. So everything throughout the day becomes ritualized in the Zen monastery. So at the way you move your hands and feet and everything is an expression of Buddha nature. So in that way, one is becoming the Buddha by acting as Buddha. There's that principle in Dogen Zen.
Fascinating. I think that's most of the questions that are making sense to me at the moment.
It's nearly 1.5 hours, so maybe I'll ask my last question to Reverend Kyokyo before you go. And that is a very straightforward, simple question. What books or videos or audios would you recommend for people who want to learn about Buddha nature in the Zen tradition? Of course, there's quite a lot of resources people can listen to and watch on your website, which is, I can't remember the address of the website, but Kyokyo Henkel, if people search it, I think it's wibbly.com. And so there's a lot there.
Name you find, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of, for study and for practice on that site, there's a lot of what I like doing is commenting on the traditional text. So there's a lot of Dogen, line by line commentaries on Dogen essays and early Chan and also Keizan Zenji. So as books to recommend, Keizan is not as known as Dogen in the Japanese Soto Zen tradition, but really Dogen and Keizan are considered kind of co-founders of Japanese Soto Zen. And I love Keizan's record of transmitting the light. It's called Denko Roku. There's a good translation by Francis Cook, another by Thomas Cleary, but I like the Francis Cook one. In fact, you can find the whole newly translated text along with the Japanese on, I think it's sotozen.net, the Japanese Soto school website. It's all in PDF form and a nice new translation of the Denko Roku, the transmission of light. And I say this because Keizan's less known. And also I really think that Keizan is really a Buddha nature teacher, even more than Dogen. Dogen is, I think, trying to ride this line between not reifying Buddha nature and honoring the emptiness teachings in a kind of careful middle way. And what Keizan is, I think, a little more courageous about talking about the true self all the time and that kind of like, you know, indestructibility of Buddha nature. His flavor is wonderful, I think. So another book is The Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor is a really great representation of early Chinese Zen. It's famous text, many translations. Red Pine has a nice one, commentary. Sun Face Buddha is the record of Matsu. And it has a very nice introduction by Mario Pocheski. Did some great work on, and he's really makes the point that Tathagatagarbha teachings are like the basis of Zen. And his introduction in Sun Face Buddha is a nice one, talking about that in particular. And Matsu, remember, is the one who coined the phrase, mind itself is Buddha and ordinary mind is the way. Spirit of Zen by Sam Van Schaik is a nice collection of early Chan teachings where Sam Van Schaik is knows Dzogchen very well too. So he emphasizes early Chan as being a kind of Buddha nature, nature of mind teaching. And it's the, he translates the record of the masters of the Lanka in that Spirit of Zen book. It's kind of new. Of course, all of Dogen's writings. I like the, if you're new to Dogen and want to just explore, a short book is, it's called The Heart of Dogen's Shobogenzo. Short book that has Dogen's most important essays, including his long Buddha Nature essay, very nicely annotated. As far as videos, one video that I came across, I thought was quite interesting, by Kempo Sodarge Rinpoche, a Nyingma disciple of Jigme Puntsuk Rinpoche. He has a talk, I think even at Berkeley, on the relationship between Chan and Dzogchen, and from 2014. I think if you just Google his name or relationship of Chan and Dzogchen, you find this video. And I was surprised that as a very traditional Nyingma senior teacher, he says he taught the Platform Sutra of the Six Ancestor like 40 times or something. He's very into Chan teaching as well as Dzogchen. I thought that was a little unusual for Tibetan Lama. So he brings out the similarities and differences in this talk, in video. There's a few that come to mind.
Thank you. Thank you, Reverend. What a pleasure and honor to have you. So much.
Thank you for inviting me.
We hope you'll come back again. There's so much that we couldn't discuss properly tonight or today for you, tonight for me. So we'd like to end this session with thoughts of dedicating this merit. Reverend, if you have a verse from Zen to end it, please lead us. Anyway, we'll dedicate the merits in thought.
May this merit equally extend to every being and place so that all may realize Buddha's way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Great discussion.
Wonderful.
Great topic.
Have a wonderful day. Thank you.